Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. Over the years on the show, we've gotten to talk to some amazing people who literally made history in and around NASA and the space race to the moon in the 1960s and 70s. So it's a special thrill to have our first NASA director on the program this week. Bill Nelson was former President Joe Biden's director of NASA, and he also was the second congressperson to fly into space aboard the Space Shuttle Columbia in January 1986, literally days before the ill-fated launch of the Challenger, which exploded after launch, killing seven astronauts, including the woman who was to be the first teacher in space, Christa McAuliffe. Bill was elected to Congress, representing his home state of Florida, where he grew up on the Space Coast near Cape Canaveral. He served for 30 years as a member of the House of Representatives and later as a senator. He has a deep love of the space program and the people who have been involved in it since its inception in 1958. Recently, the University of Florida Press released a new edition of his 1988 book, Mission, An American Congressman's Voyage into Space. He joins us to talk about his amazing career and thoughts about NASA in the past, present, and future from his home in Florida. Senator Bill Nelson, it's an honor having you, and welcome to Blue Dot.
Well, it's a pleasure. And anytime I get to talk about space and aeronautics, I'm there.
This has kind of come about because I was sent by the University of Florida Press a reissue of your great book, Mission, An American Congressman's Voyage to Space, which came out in 1988, I believe, recounting your flight aboard Columbia in 1986. So I'm just kind of curious as to, you know, what it's been like for you kind of, as this has come back out, reliving all of that and, you know, just your thoughts briefly on the reissue of this book, because it has a really cool story.
Well, when the president asked me to take over NASA, the day-to-day experiences in the last 4 years at NASA made me relive every part of the training and the mission. And in many ways, that was a very good thing because we hammered over and over on safety. And that's simply because we've lost 17 astronauts that never should have been lost, but for the miscommunication, the lack of communication between the management making the decisions and the engineers on the ground. And, of course, that happened to the next flight 10 days after our flight when Challenger launched and blew up 10 miles high in the Florida sky, and that never should have happened. So because of experiences like that, I had relived that experience, which served me very well as I tried to lead NASA for 4 years.
And we're going to get in more into your directorship and, you know, what NASA was doing while you were director here the last few years, because it's some really incredible stuff going on. But I'd like to go way back to the beginnings with you, because one of the things I found fascinating in your book is you really have deep roots in Florida. Your family, your grandparents homesteaded there. And I just found that to be the most amazing, delightful thing to think about, where they homesteaded, you know, and then for what happened to you later. Tell us a bit about your family background.
I'm a fifth generation Floridian. A great, great grandfather came to Florida from Denmark in 1829. The state had just been acquired from Spain in 1821. That was one part of the family, and he settled getting off of a boat up in the panhandle of Florida, a little town called Port St. Joe. Another part of the family comes to Florida from Chicago at the turn of the 1900s. And this grandfather and grandmother start the homestead process under the 1862 Homestead Act that encouraged people primarily to go west. And of course, we look at all the cowboy movies about the settlement of the West. The homesteaders If you work the land continuously without a break for 4 years, the government would deed the homesteaders 160 acres of land. My grandparents homesteaded on 160 acres of land between 1913 and 1917 on what today is the north end of the space shuttle runway at the Kennedy Space Center on North Merritt Island, Florida. And, you know, it was just, it almost was unimaginable for me to process that as our crew went to the launch pad for the first of five times. And I was the last crew member to crawl in and strap in. And so I wandered off on that launch tower, which is close to the ocean, and looked to the northwest, just 3 or 4 miles away, where my grandparents had homesteaded and gotten the deed for that 160 acres of land in 1917, signed by Woodrow Wilson, the president. And that was just, it was hard for me to process that my grandparents that had swatted mosquitoes, fended off alligators and rattlesnakes in a very wild Florida, in an area that was marshy, and 3/4 of a century later, they could have never imagined that a grandson was going to literally leave the face of the earth from that location.
It is an astonishing story when I think about it, and the way you put it so beautifully. I just couldn't help but think about your grandparents, and wouldn't it be cool if you could have gone in a time machine and told them, hey, Grandma and Grandpa, here's what's going to happen right here.
I never knew my grandfather. He had passed away before I was born. I had seen my grandmother before she passed. However, on another side of the family, I had a grandmother that lived until 104.
Wow.
She was a country woman, married to my grandfather, a farmer. She had never driven a car, never flown in an airplane. And when she found out that her grandson was going to fly in space, she allowed his house. She didn't like that thought one bit. Huh. But I assured her that it was going to be quite all right.
Wow.
And she smiled, not totally approvingly, but
not quite convinced.
Really deep down, you know that she was.
Yeah. That's just a wonderful family story. And you grew up literally on the Space Coast during the time when it went from, you know, a frontier land, a backwater, literally swampland, to, you know, Spaceport USA. Tell us about what it was like growing up there.
Yes. Of course, after World War II, the Soviet Union became our nemesis. And on into the 50s, under President Eisenhower as the president, all of a sudden, the Soviets shocked us and surprised us, and they launched the first satellite, Sputnik. And the whole nation was gripped with a kind of fear, but excitement that we knew we had to get into this. And they had a Navy rocket called the Vanguard, and at the Cape, and the Cape was the area, the sand spit of land sticking out into the Atlantic, that was designated as the testing ground for these early missiles, which are air-breathing rockets, not chemical-fueled rockets like our rockets of hydrogen and oxygen. And the Navy had a rocket called the Vanguard, and they were going to try to catch up with the Soviets. And it kept launching and it'd get up about 25 feet, and then it'd come crashing down.
Kaputnik.
And so that's trying to match Sputnik.
Yeah.
And that's when Wernher von Braun was called upon, the German rocket scientists that we were able to get two-thirds of those rocket scientists in the aftermath of the war. The Soviets got the other third of them. And he had what was called an Army Redstone rocket. And it then launched the first American satellite, and that was called Explorer. And then a couple of years later, 1961, we're getting ready with our original seven astronauts, and the Soviets shocked us again. And all of a sudden, they fly Gagarin for one orbit, Yuri Gagarin. And we had not had a rocket that could even go into orbit. We had that still, that Redstone rocket that could only go into suborbit. And we were preparing Alan Shepard to be the first American astronaut, not in orbit, suborbit. We launched Alan Shepard into suborbit. Then Kennedy makes that bold declaration. And he says, in a joint session of Congress, we are going to the moon by the end of the decade and return safely. And we hadn't even put up Gus Grissom in suborbit.
Yeah, we had 15 minutes of spaceflight time.
That's correct. Just very little zero-G, because you don't go into orbit. You got to get 17,500 miles an hour velocity in order to get into orbit. And we didn't have a rocket sufficient to do that that was human-rated. Well, 10 months later, we take a big chance. And John Glenn shimmies into that little Mercury capsule on top of an Atlas ICBM, which had a 20% chance of failure. And once Glenn orbited three times, the nation went bananas. And then it was Katie bar the door, and we were off on then the rest of the Mercury project with the original seven astronauts. Then the Gemini spacecraft, where two astronauts would go in the spacecraft, and then Apollo, which was a spacecraft for three that took us to the moon. By the way, one thing we did not know, because the Soviets obviously were very secretive, a space flight is launch, go into orbit, return, and land. Yuri Gagarin did not land. Even the next Soviet cosmonaut, Titov, who orbited 10 times, did not land. They did not have the capability of landing, and those two cosmonauts bailed out. But the world didn't know that because the Soviets kept it a secret. And anyway, after Glenn flew, we were off and running, and we were going to the moon, and of course, the rest is what has been told in space history.
And what was it like for you? Because I know from reading your book that you didn't aspire to be an astronaut back then, but this was all going on literally in your neighborhood.
That's right. We were in Melbourne, Florida. That's about 30 miles from the Cape, in the shadow of the Cape. A lot of the children of the people that worked at the Cape Canaveral, then it wasn't called the Kennedy Space Center, all went to high school with me. And I was this little country boy. I knew I wanted to be a lawyer, a country lawyer, and I knew I was interested in government and politics. And what a privilege it was for me to go to school in a high school, Melbourne High School, that was considered one of the 10 best high schools in the country and had a lot of its students that were the kids from the parents trying to launch us into space.
And it's cool to hear your aspirations about wanting to be a lawyer and go into politics, because, you know, people have such negative connotations about such things nowadays. But back during the, you know, the time of John F. Kennedy, you know, aspiring to public service like that was a cool thing.
It was quite an inspiring time for a young person, particularly me. And as I look back on it, after John Glenn had flown and the nation really had galvanized behind our quest to explore the heavens, John F. Kennedy made one of his most famous speeches. I think his most famous is his inaugural, in which he said, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. And I believe his second most famous speech, he went to Rice Stadium, Rice University Stadium, in September of 62, after Glenn had flown earlier that year. And that's the speech in which he says, "We go to the moon and do other things, not because it's easy, but because it's hard." And he gave an inspiration and a lift to the nation that really got everybody excited. And then, of course, December of 1968, you get into 69, you go through the other series till you get to Apollo 11, and it lands in July. What a time that was. And I think there are estimates that 3/4 of the people on Earth were either listening to a radio transmission or watching a TV when Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin landed on the moon.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us as we continue our conversation with retired Senator Bill Nelson. He flew into space aboard the Space Shuttle Columbia in 1986 and became NASA's 14th director under the Biden administration from 2021 to January 2025. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's continue now as we visit with Bill Nelson. Nelson is a fifth-generation Floridian who flew into space aboard the space shuttle, served in the House of Representatives and Senate, and became the 14th director of NASA under former President Joe Biden. His 1988 account of his spaceflight mission, An American Congressman's Voyage into Space, was recently reissued with a new preface by the University of Florida Press. Let's fast forward to you become a member of Congress, and it's just so interesting to me how things just kind of, the confluence of events with the space shuttle program becoming quote-unquote operational, and then this desire to send some people into space that aren't, you know, military test pilots. Tell us about how your avenue to get into space and how that came about.
The space shuttle started, it had been developed throughout the latter part of the 70s. It was delayed, and its first flight was April of 1981. I had been elected to Congress in 78, and I was the congressman for the Kennedy Space Center. And as I started to get seniority, I had been a member of the Science and Technology Committee and the Space and Science Subcommittee of that full committee. NASA, after the first 4 test flights, decided that the space shuttle was so-called operational. Now, that was a term of art that really was not applicable because every one was a test flight. But having declared it so, they decided first to fly university researchers so that they could get an element of science research that they had not developed in their astronaut corps. And that was the first ones called payload specialists, so that you were a special category of astronaut, not the pilot astronauts that flew the shuttle, nor the mission specialist, who usually were mission-oriented PhDs, medical doctors, etc. And having flown a couple of these researchers, the head of NASA under the Reagan administration decided that he thinks they ought to expand the program to a teacher in space, as well as to leaders in the Congress who had a responsibility for the space program. Thus, the chairman of the Appropriations Subcommittee in the Senate, Jake Garn of Utah, was selected, and later I was selected as the chairman of the Space and Science Subcommittee in the House of Representatives. And that's how I was very privileged to participate with one of the greatest crews ever. We still have reunions. Hoot Gibson, an F-4 and F-14 pilot, U.S. Navy. Charlie Bolden, the pilot sitting in the right seat, Lieutenant Colonel in the Marine Corps, both of them having flown many, many missions over Vietnam, and then a crew of just tremendous people. We've had a number of reunions. And Dave, coming up in January, it is our 40th anniversary, and we have a reunion that will be planned on January the 12th, the day that we launched 40 years ago.
It really was an amazing crew. I recall it quite distinctly, you know, when I look back on it. And one of my favorite astronauts on your crew is Steve Hawley. Just an amazing person with a background in astrophysics and just a totally cool guy. And it's just astonishing to me to think that you have two crew members that both would become directors of NASA on that same mission.
Well, it is. And the rest of the crew, just exceptionally accomplished people. You mentioned Steve Hawley. He was the flight engineer. Pinky Nelson, a PhD astronomer. Franklin Chang Diaz, who came to America not speaking English from Costa Rica, put himself through school, ended up at MIT with a PhD in plasma physics, and is developing now still a rocket, a plasma rocket that will take us to Mars much quicker than conventional chemical propulsion. And then the other payload specialist, an engineer from RCA, because we were launching an RCA satellite, and then me. And this crew really bonded, and 40 years later, we're still at it. We've become the best of friends. We actually love each other. Our families are all very intertwined with each other. It's been an extraordinary experience with incredible people, and I got to tag along and be a part of this.
Yeah, it's a wonderful story. Let's go forward a little bit. Tell us about the training you had to go through, because, you know, they don't just throw you on the shuttle without getting you ready to fly. Tell us a few of the highlights of the training from your perspective, looking back on it.
Well, you've got to meet all the medical requirements. And as a matter of fact, the only psychiatric exam that I've ever had was that. That was necessary. By the way, years later in the Senate, I used to josh with my fellow senators saying, I'm the only certifiably sane senator having gone through that exam. One of the interesting exams, you obviously can't be claustrophobic. So they don't tell you it's a claustrophobia test, but they tell you we are developing a rescue sphere so that if one shuttle got stranded and if we could send another shuttle to go get it, but we'd have to ferry the astronauts from the crippled shuttle over to the rescue shuttle, and it's a ball that inflated is probably 3.5 feet wide. And so they wire you all up and you crawl into this ball. It has an air hose in it, so you're not suffocating. They zip this thing up. You can't stand up. You can't sit. You have to curl up in the fetal position. And you're all wired up, and they tell you that we'll come get you in 4 hours. Well, obviously, if you're claustrophobic, you're going to start to have a problem. And fortunately, I didn't know any better. I curled up, and I went to sleep. And so they came in 30 minutes and got me out because they saw I wasn't claustrophobic.
You know, after all the training and everything, and you're ready to go, and you were supposed to go get out there before Christmas of 1985, it would have been, you had 4 scrubs, which is a lot. That's a lot of times to go out to the pad, suit up, get in the rocket, be ready to go, and then have to get out. And you described them all, you know, quite beautifully. One of my favorite things, you know, that I've heard from many of the astronauts, the shuttle astronauts, and you do it quite well, is that when you get out there and everybody's gone because they clear all the pad crew out because it's an explosive rocket, that beast seems alive and breathing. And you described that really well.
The most incredible sight and experience, one of the most incredible that I've ever had, because in that early morning darkness, and as you approach the pad and you get out of the crew van, and it's like a beast, and it's straining, and it's groaning, and it's hissing as if it is a beast ready to do business. All the sounds, once you get in and strap in and you hear the gurgling of some of the liquids flowing through the lines just before the ignition, you feel the gimbling of the nozzles in the tail of the space shuttle. All of this is occurring, and lo and behold, on our first try, whereas the main engines will ignite at T minus 6.6 seconds, we went down to T minus 14. I had braced my body for the ignition, and then the message came across our headsets. We're recycling back to 9 minutes, and what they got was a computer indication there was a malfunction in one of the gimbling motors in one of the nozzles of the solid rocket boosters. You don't want that thing to be malfunctioning. Otherwise, you're not going to go straight up. You'll go cartwheeling. And so that day was scrubbed. And so too, 3 more times scrubbed, any one of which, now looking back at all of the near misses, including one morning that it was very, very cold, 41 degrees. And of course, after we launched on the fifth try in a relatively warm 56 degrees, 10 days later after we landed back on Earth, Challenger launches in 36 degrees. And because of the cold weather stiffening, the rubberized gaskets called O-rings in the joints of the solid rocket boosters, that stiffened O-ring didn't seat, and it allowed the hot gases to flow out on the side right where the strut was, holding the solid rocket booster to the big apricot-colored external tank. And once that happened, it burned right through and it blew the whole thing.
Yeah, that part gave me chills, you know, when I read it, because I know what happened. And you're just reading your account of it and thinking, it's just so, it's interesting to think about Columbia being on the pad and Challenger's on the pad at the same time. You know, they're you know, right literally next to each other, a few miles apart. But it just was fascinating to me to think about, okay, Challenger's over there. And, you know, to know what's going to happen and all of the things that happened in your flight and some of those scrubs, some of those could have been quite catastrophic if you had launched under, you know, with the conditions that were going on.
That's what happened. And the Challenger crew had actually stayed with us in crew quarters because they were down there practicing, doing their practice countdown, while we're still trying to get off the ground on pad 39A, Challenger was on 39B, and that was all the more a terrible experience for us and for everybody involved in the space program when Challenger was lost.
There's a lovely photograph in your book of you aboard the Vomit Comet, the airplane that does the parabolic maneuvers that gives you a few seconds of zero G, of you holding hands with Krista McAuliffe, the teacher who passed away in Challenger, and you're both smiling and so happy. And, you know, this to see you holding hands with her was just like, I saw that. I started to cry.
Yeah. We had trained in part with Challenger, although they had a different mission. But in that case, that's exactly right.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us as we continue our conversation with former member of Congress, astronaut, and director of NASA, Bill Nelson. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's continue now as we visit with former Senator and NASA Director Bill Nelson as we mark the new paperback edition of his 1988 book, Mission, An American Congressman's Voyage into Space. Let's get to your flight, because you had this wonderful little tape recorder with you, and a lot of the, especially the early astronauts, you know, they're test pilots, they're engineers, they're not thinking about, you know, the deeper meanings of all of it all the time. But you're recording your thoughts and things on this little tape recorder. And that really does become the substance for your book and your accounts of what it was like in space. And almost every astronaut I've ever talked to talks about the overview effect of how different it is once you're out in space looking at the Earth and you realize there's no borders down there. It's not like lines on a map. It's all one planet. Tell us about what it meant to you to be up in space.
The Earth is so beautiful. It's this colorful creation suspended in the middle of nothing. And the space vacuum appears this black void, and there's home. And you orbit the Earth every 90 minutes, and you're about an hour in daylight, and then you're about a half hour in the Earth's shadow, which is the night side of the Earth. And it is just so wonderful. It's so colorful, so alive, and yet it looks so fragile. You could look at the rim of the Earth, and you could see the thin film of the atmosphere that sustains all of our life. And then you could see with the naked eye as we orbited the Earth, you could see how we're messing it up. I could see the color contrast in the upper Amazon region where they were destroying the trees. And in the same window, I could look east to the mouth of the Amazon, and I could see the silt as the additional silt as a result of the destruction of the trees upriver, where the topsoil was not held by the roots. And that would discolor the Atlantic for hundreds of miles. Same thing going over Madagascar, where they had cut down all the trees 40 years ago. You see the silt coming out contrasted against the bright blue water of the Indian Ocean. I was a public servant. I was an elected official. And I looked with a different set of eyes. And as we orbited the Earth every 90 minutes, I looked and I did not see religious division, and I did not see racial division, and I did not see political division. I saw that we are all in this together as citizens of planet Earth. And that has informed a lot of my public service since I had that experience.
Yeah, and I've heard that so many times in different iterations of it, that it, you know, it almost makes me think, you know, I wished everybody could go into space to have that, just even if just for a few seconds, to get that overview effect. And while you were on your mission, you also did some interesting medical tests. You had a job to do up there. And didn't you do the first like cardio stress test ever done in space?
Yes. I did 12 medical experiments. My primary experiment was by the Comprehensive Cancer Center at the medical school at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. And they had trained me on the experience of growing protein crystals in the zero gravity of orbit. But the other one that you're referring to, one of the 12, was setting up a treadmill and running with myself all wired up, supposedly for 20 minutes, to see the effect of getting the heart rate elevated, because we had had astronauts on spacewalks. When they really exerted, there would be skipping beats of their heart, and they wanted to do this under controlled conditions. Well, I did it for 20 minutes. I stopped. I checked the recorder, and the recorder had not recorded. So I did it again. So I ended up running on a very noisy, I mean, my crew was so irritated at me, for 40 minutes, a treadmill in space.
Yeah, because that's kind of not that huge of a space. It's not like being on the ISS, the space station. That's just in the shuttle itself.
That's right. And it's much more modernized now. I had to pull and push the mechanism with my feet. I had to keep forcing myself down. I had a shoulder harness with bungee cords to force me down onto the treadmill. But still had to force myself down with my hands on the handlebars. So it was, you know, everything's been improved just remarkably, whereas now they spend at least an hour or two a day working out on the International Space Station, because they have to. Otherwise, their bodies are just going to not respond very well being in zero G the whole time.
And, you know, you spent 6 days in space on that flight, and you come back, and then it's just not long after that Challenger launches and explodes. I hate to get into this, but just tell us about your memories of what it was like during those horrible moments, because I remember I was just about to become a teacher back then in 1986. I became a teacher in 1990-91. Tell us about it, what it was like for you, because you knew those people, you trained with them, and this, you know, Challenger was sitting there on the pad, you know, when you took off and came back.
After we had done the debrief in Houston, I went back to Washington because the Congress was in session. And so I had gathered all of our staff in front of the TV in my office and was explaining to them all the things that were going on in the countdown and then the launch. And then 73 seconds after the launch, what your eyes are seeing, your mind does not want to accept, with the contrails going off in different directions. And all of a sudden, I realized that everybody had vacated the room, and I was alone. And needless to say, that was quite an emotional moment because of what had happened to them. Unfortunately, never should have happened, as I mentioned. We found that out subsequently when we did the examination. The president had appointed Secretary of State Rogers as the head of the Rogers Commission. We did our own investigation in the House of Representatives as well. It never should have happened. The management was not listening to the engineers on the line. And we, NASA, should have learned our lesson. But about 17 years later, although for a different technical reason, Space Shuttle Columbia, the one that I flew on descent over Texas, burned up on reentry because of similar lack of communication as to what was happening. And needless to say, that was a very bad day.
It was horrible. I remember both of those days. They're burned into my memories. Okay, let's talk about something more fun. You didn't take a credit card back with you. Tell us that story, because that's pretty hilarious.
Well, we're supposed to land at the Kennedy Space Center. And we had been waved off a couple of times because of a continuing cloud cover. And the commander, who is flying the vehicle without an engine, so he has one chance to land, he's got to be able to see the runway. And so on the third try, they said, boys, it's no go at Kennedy. You're going to orbit the Earth one more time. You're going to come in on a descent over the Pacific Ocean, and you're going to land in the early morning darkness at Edwards Air Force Base in California. And Hoot Gibson, of course, had practiced for night landings as well as daylight landings, and he was right on the money, with Charlie Bolden sitting in the right seat like a chatterbox, talking him down, reading all the instruments to him so Hoot could keep his eyes straight ahead, focusing on the landing. And so they flew us all back from California to Houston. All the families were in Florida expecting to see us land at the Kennedy Space Center. My family, which lived there near the Space Center, did not have their suitcases with us because they thought I was coming right back and they were going to see me there. So everybody except my wife and children converge in Houston. And so NASA makes a reservation for me at the Nassau Bay Hilton, right across the street from the Space Center. And they get a fella to drive me over there after we have the welcome ceremony for the crew at Ellington, which is a field next to the Space Center. And I said, ma'am, NASA's made a reservation for me at the front desk. I'm saying this. And she says, yes, we have your reservation. Mr. Nelson, I need your credit card. And I'm standing there in my spacesuit. And I said, ma'am, I don't have my wallet. My credit card and wallet are back at crew quarters at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. I'm sorry, I can't check you in unless I have a credit card. Well, at that point, I didn't know. I'd been up for, 24 hours, and I didn't know whether to laugh or cry. And so, fortunately, the driver had the presence of mind. Can you use his credit card? And that's how I got a room at the Nassau Bay Hilton.
That's hilarious. Unbelievable. Some of these things, just you can't make things like that up.
No,
okay,
sir.
Well, before we run out of time, you were the director of NASA under the Biden administration and just recently left that post. And as briefly as you can, tell us about, that experience and how your time as an astronaut kind of informed that.
It was one of the happiest times in public service of my life. NASA is such a can-do organization. People are, I kept calling them wizards because they make the impossible possible. And they are just such an upbeat team that does all of these incredible things. And I had the privilege of trying to offer some leadership and become the face of NASA and to take us into new places of international alliances and cooperation. And what I found was that my experience, as I had mentioned earlier, having gone through the trauma of the Challenger explosion, where we hammered safety, that was invaluable to me. Having had put one foot in the technical part of NASA, but the other foot was the training as an elected official. And as you negotiate all the politics of Washington, the budgets with the Office of Management and Budget in the White House, along with the appropriations committees and the authorizing committees in the Congress, it was a happy experience because everybody loves NASA. I had trouble with the budgets, not in the Congress, in the Office of Management and Budget, because they always want to cut. But I had no problem in the Congress. R's and D's both love NASA. It was a place for unity. While I was there, we had the incredible James Webb Space Telescope that looks back to the very beginning of time, when the universe formed 13.8 billion years ago, with these incredible images that are now familiar to the American public and to the international community. It was a great time of new missions out exploring. The rover on Mars continued to pick up samples that we need to return, and the present administration has canceled that mission. Eventually, someone will reverse that because it's important to know if there was life there in that dry lake bed that used to be a lake with a river running down into it millions of years ago. We've sent a mission to a moon of another planet called Europa. We think that's the best chance for life in this solar system other than Earth, because it is a moon that is covered by a kilometer of ice, but underneath is a warm ocean. And where there is an ocean, we think there may be life. And so that mission is in another 4 years going to land there, and we'll get that answer. And we constantly search for life at NASA. It was a fantastic time with a great bunch of people.
Well, I wish we had hours to talk to you, Bill, about your time. It's just been a joy to talk to you about this. And the book is wonderful. I really enjoyed rereading it after all these years. And, you know, you served in Congress for 30 years as a senator and a member of the House of Representatives, director of NASA, astronaut. You were in the military. So I just want to thank you for your service to our country and the world.
Well, you're very kind, and I'll tell you, it's a joy to talk about NASA and about our space program and our aeronautics program.
It's good to remember that NASA stands for the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. Aeronautics is a huge component, too.
Correct. Well, it's great talking to you, and thank you for your interest in our space program.
Thank you, Bill. It was just a joy to talk to you.
Have a great day.
Thanks again to our guest, former congressman, astronaut, and director of NASA, Bill Nelson. You can get his book, Mission, An American Congressman's Voyage into Space, published with a newly updated preface by Bill from the University of Florida Press at your favorite bookseller. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of CAP Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.